One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Hello and welcome to the Game Football Podcast from The Times. Today we're talking about another thriller at the Bernabeu and asking just how Real Madrid always find a way to win in the Champions League. We'll also discuss the genius of Carlo Ancelotti, as well as the differing managerial situations at Manchester United and West Ham. And if that wasn't enough, we'll also take a look at Crystal Palace's continued improvement and ask, is Adam Wharton a future England star? And joining me, Tom Clark, for all of that, we have the chief correspondent for The Times and Sunday Times, Martin Samuel, football correspondent for The Sunday Times, Johnny Northcroft, and a former footballer who never played at the Bernabeu, but he did pick up big wins at Boreham Wood, Barrow, Bradford, Barnet, Bury and Burton Albion during a 14-year career. The brilliant Gregor Robertson is here too. All right with that one?
They play at Wembley. That's all where the final is.
We can do that for the previous show for the final.
It's all about your career.
I promise to mention.
Have to respond sometimes, guys.
I promise to mention the fact that you played at Wembley when we get down to Wembley. Maybe the FA Cup final. Who knows? But anyway, yes, Real Madrid have made it to that final in Wembley, and it was another cracker again in their match against Bayern Munich. Lots of things for us to talk about, chaps, but. What did you make of the game overall, Martin? Did Real deserve to win overall?
I think the best team won. Yeah. I think the best team won across the two legs. I think Real Madrid are a better team than Bayern Munich. Having said that, for all of the wonderful stadium and the atmosphere and everything like that, it still takes Neuer to chuck one in, basically, for them to get back in the game. Mm. Because at that stage, and probably until Thomas Tuchel makes those late changes, which were surprising, to say the least, it didn't look as if it was going to go their way. Having said that, Vinicius Junior is the sort of player you want to see in a Champions League final. Rodrigo, you want to see in a Champions League final. Toni Kroos, you want to see in a Champions League final. Carlo Ancelotti, I love. And, you know, I thought they were the best team.
Yeah.
Even, albeit slightly fortuitous, the way they got back in the game.
Yeah.
I thought they were the best team.
You raised a couple of good points there that we'll come on to. But Johnny, would you agree with Martin there on the overall state of that semi-final?
Yeah, I would. I love the contrast between the two semis, actually, because Dortmund and PSG were sort of the opposite. They were two kind of gauche teams who, such an open game, and you weren't quite sure why both of them were in a semi-final, but it was great watching the sort of, I suppose, the sort of youthful hopefulness of those players. But I thought Bayern Real Madrid, you saw really experienced heavyweight football sides. I know young players are on the pitch, but there's something about the know-how of the clubs, and maybe it comes from Carlo Ancelotti and Real Madrid's side and Thomas Tuchel to a certain extent. But I just thought it was a really high-class game in terms of the sort of chess aspect of it, where nobody was fazed by the occasion. You knew Real Madrid had the mental strength to not be fazed by being a goal down with two or three minutes to go. And it was a bit of an epic, really. But I do think the right team won, yeah. And like Martin, he's named some of the players that I'd like, much as it'd be nice to see Harry Kane in a Wembley final, when you think about the prospect of the names Martin's mentioned at Wembley, that's pretty good.
Absolutely. Well, you talked about the Bernabeu, Martin, and I wanted to start with that because watching this game and thinking back to perhaps the Manchester City game of a few seasons ago where it's all going well and all of a sudden you concede one and then you seem to concede again. There's something about the nature of the game in that stadium that fascinates me watching it on the television is the only way I ever have done. What's it like being in the stadium? Is there this sense that it is this cauldron that once you get on the back foot, it becomes quite intimidating for opposition teams?
Well, yes and no, because it's like a lot of football stadiums, great football stadiums in Europe, Nou Camp, and Munich Stadium, particularly the new one, which is also quite close to the pitch. The Mestalla was a fantastic stadium. The old Atletico Madrid Stadium could be like ferocious, but it's that combined with the fact that it's Real Madrid and that they've always got some of the greatest players in the world. They've invariably got a top manager, and so it's the whole thing. It's the whole package. You know, because I've been there when Arsenal have done a job on them. I've been there when Liverpool have done a job on them under Benitez. You know, and it can turn the other way very quickly as well. But it's that stadium and that team. Mm. You know, those players. The fact that anything can happen. The fact that Tony Cruz can play a pass that no one else in the field can see. The fact that Vinicius Junior, I mean, yeah, I'm not going to compare Mbappe and Vinicius Junior based on two games of football, but there is a very strong case that the best footballer in the world, when people talk about Mbappe, there's a very strong case that the best footballer in the world at the moment is Vinicius Junior, and that, you know, that's the guy that you would be paying money to see if you could pay to watch any footballer every single week. It would be him. So it's all of that. It's all of that. And this fantastic atmosphere. And, you know, you are right on top of the pitch in the new stadium as well as the average. Look, the last three times I've been to the Bernabeu, I think I've gone into a different entrance every single time because the place is being rebuilt. Mm. So the first thing you do is turn up, go to where you used to go in and pick your ticket up and discover that it's, you know, it doesn't exist anymore, and now you're walking around this stadium trying to find it and trying not to arrive at the same time as the Real Madrid coach, because that's mental. And that's how you get your pocket picked and 400 quid nicked out of your pocket, as I did about 5 years ago.
It's
a great stadium, and you know it's got a sense of history and What I'm trying not to do is to say it's an exceptional place and there's nowhere like it, because that's not true.
Yeah.
Because I've been to, you know, when Barcelona are flying at Nou Camp, that's pretty lively as well. And you can say the same about Napoli Stadium is pretty lively. You know, Napoli Stadium, which sort of explodes the myth that you've got a running track around it, so you've got no atmosphere, because, you know, that's lively.
Yeah.
Napoli is lively. So there's great places. They're great places all around the world to watch football, and I haven't watched enough club football in South America to start talking about what it's like when Boca Juniors play River Plate and
let's
things
take the
like
game
that,
podcast on tour to South America.
Yeah, absolutely. Fun, and we'll do that, absolutely.
But Johnny, what do you make of some of the points Martin's made, both about the Bernabeu and then some of the other stadiums that you might have been and reported from?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of special places, and you've got to mention Anfield as being the sort of British reference point. But, you know, Old Trafford used to be back in the day, used to be quite a special place and so on. There's something, I mean, the Bernabeu's, it's in a kind of middle-class-ish sort of nice area of Madrid, but it still feels very much part of the city. You know, it's just there's a tram stop, a tube stop. There's hotels and bars around, and there's a feeling of just really being immersed in Madrid when you're there, and people arriving there and milling around, walking back to the bars afterwards, which gives it a sort of special character. And there's a magic. Carlo Ancelotti used the word magic last night, and it's, as Martin said, it's a package. It's a stadium, it's the white shirts, it's the players that you're up against, it's hanging in the air, this history that this club does this is what this club exists for, and you're up against that. And I thought last night there was a sort of strange chain of events that wouldn't normally happen and maybe only happen because of that stadium. But it starts with the first substitution that Tuchel makes, which is a bit odd. He goes to back three when he's been defending well with a back four, puts on Kim, who had a nightmare in the first game, ends up losing a goal on that side to lose the game. Then he makes the second substitutions, which he's taking Kane off. And I he's overthinking it. And he's a fantastic manager. But that's, for whatever reason, it's occasion, is it? I don't know. He does something that's just a bit odd. Mm. And then, of course, you've got the call with the offside at the end where... Why does the linesman put the flag up?
This is what I mean. I wondered whether there's just something it gets in people's heads.
But you see that happening. It just happens in football, doesn't it? It happens at Anfield on a European night when slightly odd things might happen. The opposition makes strange decisions. Maybe the officials make strange decisions. And it's emotion. It's that factor of football that, you know, someone like Carlo Ancelotti, with all he's seen, felt it was special last night. Thomas Tuchel had a certain look in his eyes, I felt, when the first Real Madrid goal goes in and he suddenly realises he's just taking Harry Kane and Lucelle off the pitch, and oh my goodness. Yeah. And there's just a frozen look.
We should say, like, he says they were injured.
Yeah.
Evan Musiala. Yeah. Mm. So, look, I know we can scoff at that and think, yeah, it's Harry Kane, I'm sure he could have got through it. Mm. And we were also talking earlier about, you take him off with, what, 5 minutes to go, and you think there's 5 minutes to go, there's 15 to go.
Yeah,
there's always another, like, added time is much more than it ever used to
absolutely.
Be. And it's the same about Kim. You know, he brought him on with 14 minutes to go. That's 25 minutes with a player on the pitch. You wouldn't really want him for 5 minutes. Mm. So for me, the Kane and Musiala and Sané, in fact, you know, taking off all your biggest attacking threats is one thing, you know, because of the what if about extra time. But the biggest mistake was going to a back three. Mm. Like, being in that situation myself where... Yeah. It's just a change in all the relationships around you. It's not also, you know, you mentioned Burton Albion and Bury and all that. This isn't a League Two game. They weren't just chucking it in the box. Mm. You didn't need another big man in the mixer. Yeah. What they needed was the same compact defence and, you know, relationships around each other.
I thought they'd seen it off. I thought it was that period. Yeah. At the end of that period is when Bayern Munich score. Mm. And I'm thinking, they've seen it off. They've seen off that storm. And
he played
then
well.
They invited another storm.
And what does Ancelotti do? You know, he puts on a winger for a midfielder, and he puts on a sort of target style striker, a guy who's going to get in the 6 yard box. Yeah.
He also swapped his two midfielders immediately after they scored.
Yeah.
Like, right, we need fresh energy in there. Yeah. So like the substitutions were an enormous part of the change in dynamic. Of the
and
game.
Of course, there's Neuer chucking the ball back to Joselu to score the equaliser. That's the other strange event that doesn't normally happen in a football match, but you know, he's in that moment, he's in that stadium, and it happens.
But it's interesting, and I know I'm sort of obsessed with stuff like this, when the camera went on to the Munich fans, which it didn't go on the Munich fans very often because it was a Spanish director, a Spanish feed, and all about Real Madrid, the whole thing was about Real Madrid, the coverage, but occasionally it went on to the Bayern Munich fans. And to a man, you know, they're in red. They're wearing red. I don't understand. Because one of the things, you go into the Bernabeu Stadium, you're playing this club with history. You're playing this club with, as you say, the white shirts, the personality. I don't know why you go in anything other than your own colours against that white to show we're Bayern Munich. We've got history as well. You're playing Bayern Munich tonight. You're playing one of the great European clubs. Instead, they look like every club. You know, that every kit, that black every kit that everyone wears. Everyone's got a black kit because some designer somewhere decided that a black shirt goes nice best with jeans and you can wear it out in the evening or whatever. And so everyone's got this black every kit. And you think, you are up against the full personality of this football club. And that goes right the way through, from the ground to the colours that they're wearing, and obviously the players they've got. And I'm not saying you turn up in a red shirt, you win the game.
No.
But I've never understood why clubs are so happy to just write off, sign off all of their history, all of their character and personality, by just looking like everyone else. Mm, that could have been anyone. Bristol City, it could have been anyone. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? Because every club has got this all-black kit somewhere in their third kit or their, you know, special FA Cup fourth-round replay kit or whatever it is, you know, when we had them.
Yeah, well, speaking about personality, because it's an interesting point and it does feed into the Bernabeu, let's talk about Carlo Ancelotti, a man with a distinctive look of his own. Martin, he's someone that you know and have interviewed before.
Yeah, no, Carlo.
what is it about this guy? Is he, I'm posing the question, is he maybe one of the most successful yet underrated managers in the game?
I think he's underrated in as much as, I don't think he's underrated but if by people who really know their football. I think he's underrated in a sort of more general way because people sort of have the idea that he doesn't really do that much. No. That he just, you know,
almost pushes it himself, actually.
Yeah, that he sort of stands on the touchline and occasionally raises one eyebrow or whatever and, you know, sort of
good at taking the ball out of the air in those
and killing it because people forget, you know, there's a whole generation out there that don't realise what a lovely footballer Carlo Ancelotti was. And and he sort of raises his quizzical eyebrow sometimes and carries on and he's whacking these mints or whatever because what he'd really want is 20 fags. And people think he doesn't do anything. And yet, if you look at the way Real Madrid set up against Manchester City, the team was set up so well. And I know people go, oh, yeah, but Man City could have scored five. And you go, yeah, but they didn't, did they? They could have, but they didn't. And one of the reasons they didn't is because Ancelotti knows how to set a team up. And it can't be a coincidence. You don't get to win this number of Champions League trophies. You don't get to win this number of league titles by accident. You know, it doesn't happen by accident. I don't think you get to win one by accident, by the way. All this nonsense you read about Claudio Ranieri getting lucky. I don't believe that either. But Carlo is a much, much better coach, much better manager. He has a much stronger impact on a team and, you know, philosophy of what he wants to do. Real Madrid don't play like, I don't know, some of the Real Madrid teams of old. It's not as freewheeling as some of the previous Real Madrid teams have been. It is very, very structured. And, you know, I think the best team won, but at the same time, they could easily have lost that. They could easily have lost that. And Claudio finds a way... Carlo, sorry. I'll talk about Claudio Ranieri.
Got your Ranieri on.
Yeah. And Carlo finds a way of getting them through.
Johnny, yeah. Carlo Ancelotti.
Yeah, look, I think we live in the age of sort of systems and philosophies and brands of football, blah, blah, blah. And he's underrated because he's from an older school or a different school to that. There isn't a overweening philosophy. There's an idea of football that's based on these really small details and making brilliant, detailed tactical decisions, and managing an environment superbly and pragmatism, I suppose. But it's not unattractive pragmatism, but it's pragmatism. So, you know, there's no school of Ancelotti, and I think it's because of the age we live in and the way people like to deconstruct football that they might just find it hard to deconstruct what he does. But what he does is he wins, he makes genius decisions, he's got an incredible football brain. And I'd recommend, there's a great Arrigo Sacchi book, The Immortals. I'd recommend reading that for an insight in Carlo Ancelotti. It's about Sacchi's career, but Ancelotti's a kind of hidden star of the book because he's this sort of dumpy midfielder with broken knees that, you know, Berlusconi's like, why would we sign him? We can't sign him. And Sacchi's like, trust me, sign him and we'll win everything. And it's because Carlo on the pitch as a midfielder could manage the game and just couldn't run, but just had this.
What kind of a player was he? Was he like a defensive midfield sitter type thing?
With a bit more class, probably. Yeah.
Bit more class. What he said to me once that the football changed and that he couldn't play. He said, he basically said it was easier when he played. He said, when I played, he said, the ball came to you and you thought about what you would do and then you would do it. He said, and I could do that. He said, I could move it on. He said, you can't do that anymore. Mm. He said, now, he said, if you don't know where the ball is going before it comes to you, he said, you're dead. Mm. In modern football, he said, the speed of the game now, he said, the midfielders that I use that play now at this level, they have got to know where the ball is going before it arrives. Mm. He said, I didn't. Yeah. He said, I could think. He said, I had time to think about what I did with it. You've got to know before it turns up where it's going to go next. And it's, you know, so He's a modern coach. He knows the difference. He's not coaching in an old fashioned way. He's an older guy, but he's not coaching in an older way.
And he's got an effect on players. That's absolutely clear. Look at Dominic Calvert-Lewin at Everton when Ancelotti was manager. Suddenly becomes the player for a brief window in his career that had the potential to be 20 goals a season, heading it in everywhere. That's part of it as well.
Absolutely. I don't know if you saw before the game, as they're coming down the stairs onto the pitch, and Kyle shaking hands with everyone at Munich and shaking it, you know. He's a genuinely good lad. He's a really good guy. You know, he's a friendly guy, warm guy. He's, you know, comes from a farming community in Italy. His father was a farmer, but not a big landholder. He was a small farmer and they rented the land from a landowner, and the big silo of grain that they harvested every year, and then the landowner would come in and put his stick in the middle of it, and everything to the left was his and everything to the right. Carlo's father got to keep, and that sort of thing. He comes from a very, very humble background.
Yeah, has he always looked as cool as he?
Ah, you want the right. So the thing is, Carlo does look super cool now. I mean, he really does. You know, the old cardigan underneath the jacket and stuff like that. And when everyone's bouncing up and down the touchline and screaming or whatever, this guy who just sort of stands there but doesn't really sort of draw much attention to himself, and it's all in the eyebrows or whatever. But I've never forgotten staying in the same hotel as AC Milan before one of the Champions League finals. And Carlo was there in the lobby of the hotel. And it's the day of the game, afternoon of the game, and he's having a coffee and a cigarette or whatever. He's got his espresso and he's got his cigarette and he's got his white shirt on. He's got two buttons undone at the top and the tie's slightly off to the right, and his jacket's slung over the back of the chair, but he's sort of leaning on it, so that's going to be creased and buggery, basically. And if you'd walked through the lobby of that place and you'd pointed at that guy sitting there and you'd have said to someone, "Who do you think that is?" You'd have looked at him and gone, "It's probably the coach driver, isn't it? I mean, he's like 10 minutes, he's having a coffee or whatever, you know, he's going to do his tie up and he's going to put his jacket on and smarten himself up a bit and he's going to get behind the guy, and it's the coach of AC Milan." Because he's just a normal fella.
Yeah.
He's a normal fella. He's just a really good lad.
Just a normal bloke. Just to conclude on Thomas Tuchel then, obviously a man linked with lots of jobs this summer, leaving Bayern Munich. Does this match and some of the things we talked about, those substitutions, Gregor, change how we might view him going into this summer?
I'm not sure it should. I mean, you know, you heard the commentator saying, like, just after, probably before they even scored the goal, that, like, he's doing himself huge favours here, because they handled it all very, very well until that moment. And I'm sure, like, he's already said, as I say, that he had to bring those players off. Maybe his PR machine will wheel into overdrive now and try and explain why he tried to change formation and things like that too. But I think he's one of the best coaches around, and any team should be happy to have him, really.
Thankfully, I didn't have time to go through the archives to find whether any of you had ever written disparagingly about Chosselu from his time at Stoke City. Anyone prepared to own up at ever seeing him at Stoke City and thinking, "God, he'll never make a Real Madrid player"?
No, but I've read something this morning which was pretty incredible. Chosselu will become the fifth member of Mark Hughes' Stoke squad for the 15-16 season to be in a matchday squad for the Champions League final.
Oh, that's a good... Eric, wow. What's his name? Choupo-Moting?
No.
No?
Peter Crouch, Bojan...
Bojan.
Ibrahim Afellay and Shaqiri.
Shaqiri, bloody hell. I also read, I haven't checked it, but that he scored more goals in a Champions League semi-final than he did at the Britannia. Apparently. Or the Bet365.
Listen, there's hope for all of us yet. Well done, Tuchel.
See, Thomas Tuchel could argue, I did the match-winning thing. I brought a bloke on who used to play for Stoke. It just didn't work for me.
Very good, very good. Well, let's go from Chosselu to Kylian Mbappe, a striker who didn't
make it
to the Champions League final. His PSG side beaten by Borussia Dortmund. And speaking of slightly kind of ragtag success stories, Borussia Dortmund is a fantastic achievement, isn't it, to make it to this Champions League final, Johnny?
Oh, it is. It's great. And look, we've been extolling the Bernabeu, but I mean, my goodness,
that's a place.
You know exactly, and that's a support. You know that, and that's going to be great fun seeing them at Wembley and with the Madrid fans. They were the better team. I mean, they were better over those two games than PSG. Some incredible performances. I mean, we spoke about Sancho in the first leg, and he wasn't so imposing in the second leg, but you know, what a first leg performance. But I mean, Marcel Sabitzer, if we're talking about players who looked not so great in the Premier League, I mean, how good was he? But I mean, Mats Hummels was the performance of arguably him and Vinicius of the whole sort of semi-final round, as it were. I mean, that was a colossal performance in both boxes, and defensive leadership in an era where there aren't many that can defend or do it. I thought Rudiger was amazing as well, by the way, for Madrid. But yeah, Hummels, I mean, my goodness, what a classy guy as well. And it's a great Edin Terzic as well, is a fantastic story, isn't he?
Yeah, absolutely. Do you know more about Edin
Terzic? Yeah, well, there was a picture doing the rounds on Twitter that of him as a fan 12 years ago at a Dortmund game. Strangely looked older then than he does now, but and he's worked in a number of roles for Dortmund: scout, youth coach. He might have even been an analyst at one point. Obviously, took over as a number two, and now there he is in the Champions League final. And if you think about the fact that they really should have won the Bundesliga last year as well, when they blew it on the final day. I mean, there's a body of work there from Dortmund. Yeah, they haven't challenge for the title in Germany this year, but you know, they've, for a club of their size and budget, and Ian Matson, I mean, you go on, just there's so many things you look at and you just think that's just brilliant.
The contrast between them and PSG and now with between them and Real Madrid in the final is remarkable, just in the journey that a lot of these players have taken. Füllkrug was playing in the second tier 2 years ago for Werder Bremen. You know, 30, his career has just blossomed. Said about Sancho, Sabitzer was, you know, not wanted by Bayern. Hummels wasn't wanted by Bayern. Hummels as well played in the 2013 final at Wembley, which they lost to Bayern.
He's got about 60 now, isn't he, Hummels? I feel that I've been watching him for 30 years.
Yeah. Royce as well, I think he played in that final too, the last time they made the final. And he's probably leaving in the summer. We've said about Matson was, you know,
brilliant.
So many that have kind of, they were cast-offs almost.
Yeah.
Which is in, you know, stark contrast to a team of PSG standard and Real Madrid.
And when you're talking about journeys that clubs have been on, who knocked Borussia Dortmund out of the Champions League last season?
I'm not doing well on the quiz questions today.
Graham Potter's Chelsea.
There you
go. There you are.
Graham Potter, where's he doing?
Graham Potter's Chelsea eliminated Borussia Dortmund from the Champions League last season.
Just shows.
So, you know,
anything is funny.
That's my favourite one, apart from the thing that was in Bill Edgar this week, that the last time when Forest Green Rovers played Ipswich Town last season.
Yeah.
Did you read this? It was a fantastic stat. When Forest Green Rovers played Ipswich last season, Ipswich were below Forest Green Rovers.
Wow.
Who will next season, Forest Green Rovers will start life in the National League. Ipswich will start life in the Premier League. And that's why the pyramid's wonderful.
It's all right when you're doing the quiz questions. When I do, I get in trouble, honestly. Well, I just
in trouble. Paranoia. Just because.
Just to very quickly finish on that match.
Green career prospect.
Well, someone with not very grim career prospects, Kylian Mbappe. A huge superstar and a big game player, there can be no doubt about that. But he didn't necessarily step up in this game. Johnny, do we think this is the final kind of knockings of this PSG era finally getting to him? We need him to get out, don't we? We need him to get out, to get to another club and start seeing the wonderful player that he is.
Yeah, I think so. He wasn't at his best, but I mean, a guy that's scored a World Cup final hat-trick or whatever it was at the age of 12 is he's a pretty good big game player. It was just an off night, and yeah, I think when he's so much the finished Uber player, and a lot of those PSG players are, you got to wait 5 years for them to come good, and there's some brilliant talent there, but it's a players in development, and they're not going to develop quickly enough for him, so he needs to go.
I always hate when you say it's a kind of a waste of talent, but it does feel like it's been the wrong platform for his talent. Mm. I know it's easy for me to say, it was his hometown club, it was a huge project, but I don't know, for 7 years, for him to have been there,
it's
for
a long
7 years,
isn't it? Yeah.
It is a long, long time. And I don't know, I just feel like...
Does he go to Real Madrid? They've got Chosselu, they've got Vinicius Jr., they've got Rodrigo.
This is the only thing that you know, I can see the argument, he needs to get out of Paris Saint-Germain, and it certainly wasn't a performance that would make you think anything else. Whether he needs to be Real Madrid centre-forward, bearing in mind they're getting to the Champions League final, and they will be favourites for the Champions League final, even though I think that Dortmund are organised and could cause them a problem. Whether he needs to be Real Madrid centre-forward, whether that's what we want, is another matter, really, because you'd like to see it spread around a little more. You know, you'd like to see him somewhere else to bring another team up, you know, but it looks like it'll be Real Madrid, doesn't it?
Yeah, I'll take him at Lincoln. I'll start the crowdfunding now. If you've got views on where you think Kylian Mbappe should end up next season, or perhaps you've got your own memories of being at the Bernabeu, you can get in touch with me, tom.clark@thetimes.co.uk. But for now, stick with us. We're talking about Crystal Palace and Manchester United next.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal, to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Here's a question for the marketers listening. Want to find that perfect customer beyond the world of scrolling, swiping, and searching? Here's a secret to make sparks fly. Smooth talking with podcast ads. With Acast, you can reach millions of listeners who'll be hanging on your every word. On the train to work, in the gym, or waiting in line for coffee. Start up the conversation with podcast listeners anywhere and everywhere. And they're looking for love. 60% of listeners have a higher trust in brands they've met on podcasts compared to social. Get closer to your audience. Make podcast ads with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
Hello and welcome back to the Game Football Podcast. I'm Tom Clark, and today I'm joined by Martin Samuel, Johnny Northcroft and Gregor Robertson. Now, it's Thursday, chaps. It feels like a long time since Monday, but we're heading back there to discuss two of the bigger issues of the week. And let's start with Crystal Palace's 4-0 win against Manchester United. It comes to something for Manchester United in their season when my colleague Joe Hare, who is a Crystal Palace fan of the most cynical variety, said, I think we'll beat them, to be honest. I'm not sure he thought they'd beat them 4-0. But let's start with Palace before we get into United and Erik ten Hag. Gregor, this is quite a remarkable transformation, isn't it, from Oliver Glasner in such a short space of time. I know we talked a lot about Palace's, what do they do moving on from Roy? Will they end up coming back to a manager like Roy because they won't get someone in who can make these players work? Well, he clearly can. He's won against Liverpool, West Ham, Newcastle, draw with Fulham, and now beaten Manchester United 4-0 in five games.
Yeah, his impact's been remarkable, really.
And he's changed the style as
he
well.
Has, hasn't he? So I was at the bar, I think it's Burnley was his first game. I think I was at that game, and you saw it immediately. They played 20, 30 yards higher up the pitch straight away from the off, and they pressed high. Just much more compact. It was really clear. You know, there was clarity in what their approach was. It was a 3-4-3 or 3-4-2-1, and really compact everywhere. Front foot defending as opposed to defending the box. And you know, they didn't even have, you know, Elise and Eze then. They didn't have the really talent, you know, they're kind of they're shining stars. Mm. Jordan Ayew stepped up that day, I remember. And Adam Wharton, they've got a player with a brilliant future. And from the start, you saw it. You kind of, the way he gets on the ball and looks forward and picks out runners or curls balls into the box. For Mateta, who's obviously been reborn as well under Glasner, he's been a massive signing for them. But just as I say, I think it's just about the, you know, they've Munoz as well, another one. He's a right back.
Love
but
Munoz.
He seems perfect for that.
Just love that he has his shirt tucked in and his shorts pulled up quite high. He looks a bit like Simon Cowell on the football pitch, but I really enjoy it.
But it seems like that's a system that really suits him. There's a question about Tyrick Mitchell, whether he's done really well, but whether he's quite got enough going forward to be that the long-term solution in that role. But for everyone else, for Alisi and Eze to almost have like two number 10s, it's perfect for them. Yeah. And, you know, even Richards at the back is kind of playing his best football for the club. So I think...
And they're scoring the kind of goals that we associate with modern football. Johnny mentioned it earlier, talking about Carlo Ancelotti, this desire for nice, beautiful, on-the-eye football. The goal they scored at Anfield against Liverpool was a wonderful goal. Classic modern football goal. Pinched it in midfield, turned it over, overlapping fullback, cut back, tapping. Beautiful stuff.
I mean, it's what Gregor says about playing 30 yards further up the pitch. When you've got forwards like those, and Eze and Alicia suddenly receiving the ball in the final third. I mean, what a difference that makes. I won't forget Eze's performance at Arsenal this year in the 5-0 defeat, which I think we talked about it on this pod, and he was sensational. He was picking the ball up in his own half, because that's where Palace were. Mm. So, I mean, Glasner obviously comes from the Ranić school. His Frankfurt team was super intense, super pressing, very similar to what we're seeing now, very dynamic, and it really suits when you can put two number 10s on the pitch. It's brilliant. But Wharton, I just wonder if Gareth Southgate missed a trick, because, or maybe it's just timing, but he used those March internationals to have a look at Maino, which was quite right, and he's fantastic. But I wonder if he might regret not having had a look at Wharton as well.
Is there still time? Greg has written an excellent profile about him today, in which you posed the question but said maybe a bit late, and then me and the editors have mischievously put a headline on it saying, nah, he could make the Euros anyway.
Nice one. I look forward to the comments about that.
You've not seen it yet. No, but it's up for discussion. It is an interesting talking point, isn't it? A lot of people saw this matchup, Maino against Wharton, and went, hang on, we've gone for the wrong, which is the classic modern football overreaction. But
recency bias too, because we remember what we thought after Maino's performance.
Yeah, they're different players as well.
They are.
Yeah. You know,
Maino's someone who can really carry the ball. He's very good defensively. Wharton's played as a number 10 in his youth, but it's because England are so short of people playing in that kind of holding midfield role. And he's got a real bite in the tackle as well.
Yeah,
I think there's a stat where since his full debut against Chelsea, no one's made more tackles and interceptions combined than him, no other Premier League midfielder. So it's like he is really good at stepping out, jumping to make a challenge, but he's also really class, just kind of the kind of player where he's always looks like he's got time and space, and he's got a wand of a left foot, and the little pocket of space he always picks up. He plays on the right. Will Hughes has also been excellent recently for Palace, so they've got two left-footed midfielders. Because he plays on the right, he often gets the ball off Munoz or someone in that little inside pocket in the right, opens up, and he just curls an in-swinger into the box, which we saw for the third goal. Tyrick Mitchell swept it, and he's brilliant at that. So he's got both sides to his game. I still think it would be a big ask for him.
I think it's a bit late,
Martin, Adam Wharton, too late for an England push?
I'd like to say too late, really, because you don't know what can happen in the last two or three games with injuries.
Yeah.
Palace are the form team. Mm. But we've had this conversation on here before, and international football, the opportunities are so rare and so few and far between, that if someone has a good game, a good half sometimes, that's it, right? We've had a look at him and he didn't let us down and, right, he's in. So you've got all of that to overcome, like the fact that Kobbie Mainoo, who we didn't think was going to get a chance at one stage, you're thinking, oh, he's going to go with Jordan Henderson, and then events sort of fell for him, and he ended up playing. And he ended up involved in both matches, didn't he? And
Plus, the comparison between them is unfair. Because Mino's playing
totally
in a team that is so dysfunctional. And all the things we just said about Glasner's Palace team, the contrast between that and Manchester United is stark.
I'm referencing the kind of social jokey media, social media knee-jerk reaction type thing. There's no reason they can't both be in the squad, isn't there?
I think this is where big club bias comes in, but in an understandable way, because I think the argument against putting Wharton in would be it's just not enough time to understand whether he can just handle the environment, because the next internationals are actually warm-ups. You're in the squad if you're playing in the next ones, basically.
But he can name a bigger squad and then he reduces it after those warm-ups.
Yeah, yes, granted. But I mean, that's kind of his... Yeah, okay. But I guess the thing, at least with Mainoo, and he's looking at the fact he can hack it, as it were, in the pressured environment of playing for Manchester United. And I know fans of other clubs hate big club bias and you know, I understand that, but I think that's what comes into the manager's thinking. It's like, I know that he can handle that level of scrutiny, and I don't know, this guy might just need a bit more time.
I think it's timing rather than the kind of even his experience, because I mean, I remember writing when Calvin Phillips was in the Championship that it didn't matter that he was playing in the Championship, he should have been put in that in the squad, and he made his England debut before he made his Premier League debut, although they had just won promotion.
Yeah.
And then by the end of that season, he was England's Player of the Year. He played in the Euros final. Like I think it's just the time, and it's too close to the Euros to chuck him in now.
The sort of players that get chucked in, you know, this late are some, you know, centre forwards, it's just an astonishing game changer rather than someone that would have to be a cog in the wheel. He's got the cogs in the wheel. He knows which ones that he can trust. And I know I absolutely get everyone's point here about big club bias and how much people hate it or whatever. But it's undeniable that if you're a manager and you're looking at someone, you're looking at a kid and you're thinking, if he can get in the team every single week at Manchester United, and Kobbie Mainoo, once has got in any team, he hasn't got out of it, basically. They haven't been able to get him out of it. So he got into the Manchester United team and they haven't got him out of it yet. Well, once he can do that, and he got in the England team, and now you're looking at him, and people are saying, well, he should start. And, you know, it could be the same with him in England, that he could get in the team and just not get out of it. And, you know, that does mean something to a manager, that, you know, that this is a kid that can go out in front of nearly 80,000 people and not be fazed by it and not shrink. And Alex used to say the thing about, you know, some people sort of get overwhelmed by the jersey and other people put it on, and I was made to wear this shirt, you know, and mine who looks like that second sort of person.
But just back to Wharton, you do have to say that it's been an extraordinary transition when you consider that he came on deadline day.
Yeah.
You know, 2 weeks late, you know, I think that was five days before he turned 20.
Mm. Mm.
2 weeks later, Roy Hodgson took ill. New manager came in. And he started every game since his debut, which was a tricky debut against Brighton, where he gave away the ball for the third goal. They lost 4-1. Roy Hodgson was getting pilloried from the stands. You know, they were in a relegation battle. It looked like they were going to be. And he started every game since. And it's hard to think of many players who've made that step from the Championship quite as seamlessly.
Yeah.
I'll go back to James Maddison, actually, I think. Probably. Yeah. That's a long while ago. It's done it so quickly. I mean, Palace have got Elise and Eze, and there are so many, Jared Bowen, so many players who've made the step up very successfully. But to have done it so quickly at such a young age says a lot about him.
Yeah. Do you mention Eze? John, you're not prepared to put Adam Wharton in the squad, but you said a few weeks ago Eze was your bolter back then, but he's straight in now, isn't he?
All day long. Oh, absolutely, yeah. Yeah, I mean, just bringing him on in any circumstance, or starting him, I just think he's one of the best players in the country, bar none. And if we're talking about trying to keep Kylian Mbappe away from Real Madrid to spread talent around, there's a big part of me that just thinks it's just pass a law that means that Eze and Elise stay at Crystal Palace. we need strength like that around the league. What they make that club and that team so distinctive.
Honestly, I wish this podcast was filmed so that listeners could see the joy in your face when you talk about Eberechi Eze. It really is a wonderful thing to see. Now, we must talk about Manchester United. And listener Barry Lucas got in touch with me after Monday's game. Said, Tom, you're going to have a field day on Thursday. For what it's worth, in my opinion, Ten Hag should go now. We are not going to win the FA Cup. In fact, the match should be called off and City handed the cup, the proceeds of ticket sales given to charity. Give the manager, new manager, some time to assess the squad and be there for the summer break, transfers and sales. I know there have been injuries, but so have other clubs. I expected to lose maybe 2-1 or 1-0, but 4-0? Casemiro? So embarrassing. He should pack it in and go far away. Can it get much worse? Barry, I think it probably can. But let's talk about Manchester United and that first question that Barry was asking, because that was one of the things we were talking about after this match. Mm-hmm. Erik ten Hag, for a long time, and as Paul Hurst was writing on the Times website this week, we believe we'll get to the end of the season, and then we imagine, if it keeps going this way, that he will probably part ways. Is there any sense that anyone thinks that it's got, after a match like this, that they'd be better off going the kind of Ryan Mason route like Tottenham have done in the past? saying, Darren Fletcher, you used to play the game, didn't you? You go on, you just give a team talk and it might be a bit better than this.
I just think you've got to give the man the FA Cup final. You've got to give him this far. You give the man the FA Cup final. And then, look, we were talking earlier and I said, look, I think it'd be madness to get rid of Erik ten Hag before the FA Cup final. I also think it would be madness to have Erik ten Hag taking you into next season, given what we've seen week in, week out for Manchester United. So, but I do think, you know, you don't change now. I mean, that's Barnsley stuff, isn't it? Was it Barnsley who sacked their manager
before
a couple of
playoffs,
years ago? Got knocked out in the playoffs, you know. And so, I mean, you can't go down that route. They're meant to be sensible people. But at the same time, you just look at that the other night and just think, it is... I didn't expect 4-0, but 3-0 I expected. I mean, seriously, we were talking about it before. One of my lads is in a league of like results prediction, and there's a bit of money on it, and he's like about a point off the top, and he's getting quite excited about this, and he had 3-0 Crystal Palace. And he said, "What do you reckon?" I said, "I agree with you." You know, and you shouldn't be sitting there thinking Manchester United are going to get beat 3-0 by Crystal Palace, and you know, he thought he was a little bit out there, you know, like in his little league, he's going to be the only person who's going 3-0 Crystal Palace, but he probably wasn't. He probably wasn't. I bet there was a few people who went 3-0 Crystal Palace because they look 3-0 better than Manchester United at the moment. Yeah. Head to head, that team looks 3-0 better than Manchester United.
Yeah, well, part of the reason for me reading out Barry's email is that as a Manchester United fan, I thought it was interesting to get his view, because I find, as an editor on a sports desk of a national newspaper, that a lot of people get in touch sometimes talking about the media general bias against Manchester United. And I often have, you know, fairly constructive conversations with them.
People, when they were winning everything, right, I covered Manchester United when they were winning everything. I was there when they won the treble. I was there for all of Manchester United. Man, I used to have people coming up to me going, "You've got it in for Manchester United." And you're like, "What are you talking about? We write nothing but good things about Manchester." Every now and then, say Roy Keane might snap somebody's leg in half, and you think, and you write a piece that says, "That wasn't good." But, you know, and people still thought you had it in for Manchester United.
Yeah, but I wanted to talk about that in the age, and we've touched on it throughout the show, about modern football and how we consume it. Is there something with Manchester United, because they were so good, and there have been many teams that have been good, Arsenal under Wenger, and towards the end of his career it all changed, Liverpool before that, which was before my time, but I'd be interested to know whether the kind of Liverpool in the 90s was all very reflective of their success in the 80s and before. Is it because of the success that, you know, certain fans may be thinking, everyone's out to get us, when, as Barry himself says, as a Manchester United fan, there's not necessarily much positive that we could talk about. Johnny, what do you think about this idea around Manchester United and the media in general?
Well, I mean, one thing when Martin was talking, I thought about the fact how City fans think everyone hates them at the moment because they're so successful, and there may be something about that success mentality that you get frustrated if it's not 100% praise. But no, the United situation reminds me a bit of Liverpool when I started covering Northwest football, which was around 2001. Hooley was in charge, and actually Liverpool were much, much better than Man United are now. But he seemed embattled, even though things were going quite well. There was a pressure on them. He talked a lot about all these ex-players in the media, and this makes my job impossible, and you know, and there are echoes of that, and I think it just comes from the scale of the club. Mm. But being objective, Manchester United is an extraordinary, excruciating, Aroni's car crash, isn't it? I mean, it just keeps going on. Mm. And if you think about it now, at the very moment they get the red knight in Jim Ratcliffe coming in to save the club, which takes about 6 months anyway, so that gets drawn out, which is agony for fans. At that very moment where it's like, right, now it's about the long-term plan, now it's about finally making sensible decisions, they then appoint a sporting director who, still a gardening leave, can't work for another year. You know, the chief executive hasn't arrived yet, and now the manager's suddenly doing so badly that we're asking this question. Because I'm sure the idea when they took over, and they're still clinging to it, was let's be methodical about this. Mm-hmm. Let's do our British Cycling style, you know, big survey of what we need to do, and then we'll make the decision. And we'll wait for the chief. We'll wait for the chief exec in place. We'll wait for the sporting director. But the sporting director, he's not there. The chief exec's not there. Mm-hmm. And in the same time, the manager's
now taking along.
And it's not taking along. And the manager's now doing so badly that it's becoming that crisis point where you're looking at it thinking, how, you know, yeah, give him the cup final, but could you give him a transfer window?
Mm.
Could you give that club any more sort of loss of prestige and morale? Can you expect Kobbie Mainoo to develop any more, you know, if he has to play another month of that kind of dysfunctional football? It's a fascinating story.
I think it's interesting, Johnny's point about the kind of ex-players in the media thing. Because, as I say, when I was growing up watching football, it was Alan Hansen and Mark Lawrenson and things. And well, now, as a journalist, it's Gary Neville, Rio Ferdinand, Paul Scholes.
I was just about to say that what people forget is the pressure that Liverpool were under was because Liverpool had just been the great team, the dominant force in English football. So all of the people on television and lots of people writing in the newspapers and everything like were all ex-Liverpool players, all saying this is going wrong, this it wasn't like this, and you know they've lost this and they haven't done it. And it was Hansen and Lawrenson. The difference was when Alan Hansen or Mark Lawrenson or any of these had a go about Gerard Houllier's scene, for instance, it wasn't then edited.
No.
And released as 25 TikTok snippets and on YouTube and on Instagram and on the back page of every newspaper, which, bizarrely now, you've got some media outlets that quote Gary Neville and Jamie Carroll, but Gary, you know, we're talking Manchester United, so quote Gary Neville, Paul Scholes, Rio Ferdinand, Roy Keane, quote them more than they quote their own people. Mm. You know, they'd rather Gary Neville said Manchester United were rubbish than the person who's reporting the match say Manchester United are rubbish. So you've got this constant thing that must feel like there's this sort of maelstrom around the club the whole time where they can't do right for doing wrong.
Mm.
And I've got a degree of sympathy for them on that. Say like the Mason Greenwood thing, which was a really, really hard situation for them to try to manage. And in the end, whatever they did, somebody was going to say, well, they haven't done this quite right. They haven't got this quite correct. They should have done it like this, or they should have done it like that. And because we're in the modern media world, there's just so much of it.
Mm.
You know, this podcast didn't exist when Liverpool were rubbish, yeah, and Mark Lawrenson and Alan Hansen were pontificating every week on Match of the Day and you know, telling people how good it used to be. Podcasts like this didn't exist. Yeah. Podcasts didn't exist, basically. All you know, there was no such thing as a podcast.
Yeah,
you know?
Absolutely. Gregor, I want what do you think about this scenario as well? Because, you know, let's take another team, big team, who've had great success recently. Chelsea is another team that you've been incredibly critical of. We all have. What a joke, all this money, etc., etc. I'm sometimes interested in fans' reactions to that, because we've talked here about brilliant Champions League, and Johnny, you've just said, oh, Eze and Elise should stay at Palace. And we want teams to be good, don't we? We want them to be good. We want, essentially, we would love it if Chelsea and Manchester United were both great, because then we wouldn't be going, God bloody hell, let's hope Arsenal stay in this title race to the end of the season, because we'd have a 4-5 team title race. Yeah. Is that not fair?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose what we're really criticising above anything is the management of the football clubs.
Yeah.
And I think these are things that we don't really have a great expertise in, but you can see when...
Neither do they, by the way.
That's fundamentally, yeah. Like, Chelsea's owners came in with no expertise in it and tried to...
But that's what I mean, you're criticising them because you want Chelsea to be good at football.
I'd much prefer to see a club being run...
Every horse race to be a blanket finish.
Yeah.
You want every horse race to be... 10 horses going for the line, neck and neck. You can't, you know, that's what you want. You want you'd like the title race. The most disappointing thing about this title race is that Liverpool have dropped out of it. The most disappointing thing about the battle between fourth and fifth is it looks like Aston Villa are going to get it all their own way. You know, that's, you're disappointed. But, you know, you really want the competition all the time.
Johnny.
Well, if we talk about coverage, I do think there's a hype machine around these big clubs, and that's maybe where they're culpable. Mm-hmm. They invite it on themselves. You know, it happened at United already. Jim Ratcliffe's in town, and there's been a hype around.
He says the toilets are dirty.
There's been a hype around what's going to happen. There's a hype every time a young Man United striker scores a goal. Do you know what I mean? There's a hype around Chelsea, and the owners fed it. They created it. They wanted it. If I think back to Liverpool in the day. Yeah, there was probably a hype created by Hule, who was trying to position himself as a bit of a messiah figure. So there's a cycle that these clubs, I suppose, do feed. So then when it goes
and they monetize
wrong,
it.
And they monetize it, exactly.
So let's be honest, it works both ways, absolutely.
Yeah.
It's hard to have sympathy for a football club that's been run so badly, essentially, for me. I have great sympathy for teams that look dysfunctional or poorly coached or players who are having a really bad time. You know, I have sympathy for when I'm watching Chelsea early in the season, like, because I just felt like there was a lot of young guys being thrown into something. They're looking around each other and seeing probably, you know, guys with the same sort of mindset as them, as this is new and big and a little bit daunting, and they probably need a bit of leadership, and it wasn't there. So I had sympathy for them. I have no sympathy for billionaires who come in and think they're going to disrupt the system. Well,
When you look at Chelsea now, so Chelsea are finally beginning to get it going a little bit towards the end of the season, and there is a chance they could be in Europe. And, you know, I'm often watching football with a couple of Chelsea fans, and they're, you know, I've watched them, like, sitting on the sofa, squaring at the television like I usually do when my team's on. And I've watched it all season, and now they're suddenly quite positive about the performances. And then you pick up the paper and it says they're probably going to not be allowed into Europe, even if they do qualify, because the sums aren't going to add up, because you're not allowed to use that amortisation process that they've got away with in the Premier League. You're not allowed to use that in Europe because you owe for
55 minutes we managed, and you've managed to sneak amortization.
But I'm not going to, you know, it's anchoring, like, sort of sneaking. Hey, this is amortization, and so you look at that and think, and what genius didn't spot that one coming? So what genius on the board of directors didn't look at that and think, well, we can amortize this in the Premier League, but if we actually achieve our ambition of getting into Europe, they don't allow you to spread the money over 8 years.
I thought they closed the loophole quicker.
Yeah, they did.
But either way, did they not look and think they might close this loophole?
They might, yeah.
No more loopholes.
Do you know what I mean? So that is an executive decision.
Yes.
That has nothing to do with those players. It's
madness.
It's madness, yeah.
It's madness signing players on 8 and 9 year contracts.
Absolutely.
I mean, what are they thinking?
Anyway, another executive decision that we need to talk about from earlier in the week is West Ham's decision to part company with David Moyes, one of the more successful managers of recent years. Gregor, we talked about it briefly as the news was coming out as we were recording Monday's show. Martin, as a West Ham fan, but also as a journalist, this feels like a slightly healthier break than the one we're envisaging between Manchester United and Eric Ten Hag.
It's the same one as with Sam Allardyce, where at the end, the man's contract runs out, you shake hands, and you fair exchange, no rubbery. So, you know, West Ham have been very good for David Moyes. David Moyes has been very good for West Ham. If the club believe it's run its course, and it quite possibly has, okay, that's it. And you shake hands. No one gets sacked or anything like that. There's been stuff about the fact that they were talking to other people beforehand, but then again, they offered a contract earlier in the season, which didn't get taken up. So I don't think it's the biggest crime to actually appoint the new manager, have the new manager before the other one's gone out. And that's it. I don't feel that, you know, he did a great job for West Ham.
Where does he rank for you in terms of, I'm not asking you for your full list, but what does he come to mind? What does it conjure? Obviously, won that amazing trophy, that amazing night in Prague.
Absolutely. I mean, if you build it on, if you do it on that, then he's up there in modern West Ham managers, without a doubt.
Johnny, David Moyes, someone you know well, obviously he's written columns for us before. What do you think of his time at West Ham, and where does this leave him now going forward?
Well, the next guy is not going to be as successful, and I doubt West Ham are going to have a manager as successful as David Moyes. You know, he's on course for a third top 10 finish in 4 years, saved them from relegation twice. We talked about Frankfurt; they were a Europa League semi-final with them, European trophy. Good run this year. I mean, he's not going because he's not successful, and that's the point here. He's going, I suppose, because the fans and the, which Martin will understand better than me, and the directors want a change of direction, whatever that is. I take it that means style of play. I take it that means a different sort of set of players on the pitch in terms of recruitment. So I just think it's sad for David because he couldn't have done any more, and I think it's sad that the comms around this aren't a bit clearer, because I think they need to be honest and just spell out that this is why we're doing it. It's nothing to do with this guy's body of work. We just want something new, and there's a validity to that, because football's an entertainment and we all want to change the menu at some points in time. But it's what's up. I mean, a lot of it's upset me, I suppose, but I've read quite a few pieces this week where when a manager gets sacked, there's always a bit of a rewriting of history by journalists, and you know, it's part of how our industry works, because it's they're fed by certain people, might be talking about the agents, might be talking about the clubs, who are now seeking to justify a decision like that. And that's happened with West Ham, and you know, you're just reading things like the recruitment was terrible, when you look at
the recruitment,
you look at Lucas Paqueta putting the ball through to Jared Bowen and think, who signed those players? Do you know what I mean?
No, the recruitment wasn't terrible at all.
Recruitment wasn't terrible. You know, there's he couldn't work with us. I mean, David's a strong character, but to work in that environment is not easy. And the fact that he was able to do that for 4 years is pretty good. I had an argument with a West Ham fan this week who was trying to tell me that, you know, oh, he didn't sign Jared Bowen. You know, that was a chairman. I mean, when you get into that level where history's getting rewritten to the point where literally the only manager that would have signed Jared Bowen and put him on the pitch
from the Championship as well. So,
yeah, someone's now saying, "Oh no, he didn't sign him. No, that was his chairman. That was the scouts." I mean, let's just not rewrite history. He's had an amazing time at West Ham. He'll go on and do something good somewhere else. I don't think towards the end he was appreciated properly, but that's also, I know there's a lot of West Ham fans who do appreciate him, like Martin, so maybe you get guided by social media, and sometimes that doesn't reflect what people actually think.
I think
you said that they've been good for each other.
The biggest mistake that West Ham made this season is nothing, well, I don't know if it's anything to do with David Moyes, but I would presume it's not, is that they let Pablo Fornals and Said Benrahma go in the January transfer window, didn't replace them. Well, Calvin Phillips, but that didn't work. And if you look at the matches between now and the end of the season, now whether this is a fault of David and he should have gone to the youth players more, or whether, it, you know, time will tell whether the youth team is as good as West Ham fans believe it is, because it's done well. But in the end, there was no one off the bench. You know, there was no one off the bench. And that came back to haunt them in Europe, because they got to 10 minutes to go against Bayer Leverkusen in Germany and held them 0-0 with a game plan that there was quite negative, but you're playing one of the best teams in Europe. And then Xabi Alonso can bring on fresh legs and players that he trusts who won the game.
Yeah.
And David Moyes couldn't. David Moyes was stuck with players that were clearly exhausted. And that's because squad players that might have come on, that might have provided something, were sold in January. That's not smart.
No.
And I think the situation where it was clear that at the very least the club weren't unified in wanting to keep him, that's at best, but you know, at worst, a situation where every time there's a bad result, there's a briefing about how he's now only got one game to save his job. I mean, this instability, I think, has affected the end of West Ham season. And the fact those players have been playing kind of knowing now the manager doesn't really, the club's not sure about keeping him. You know, that we know that through history that affects players when they're not sure if the guy who's telling them to run is actually going to be in charge next week.
Yeah, well, David Moyes has his final home game for West Ham this Saturday against Luton Town, so we'll see how the fans show their appreciation. But for now, Martin Samuel and Johnny Northcross and Gregor Robertson, thank you very much for joining me. Thank you too for listening. As I say, we'll be back on Monday to talk about Moyes, West Ham and much more.
Hey marketers, want a matchmaker to set you up with your perfect audience? Well, look no further. Get intimate right away with host-read sponsorships with Acast. Use Acast's self-serve ad platform to search and partner up with a podcaster or two from our network of more than 100,000 shows. Have them sing your praises in their own words. And get their listeners ready to be wooed into loyal customers. It's the ultimate loving endorsement. Book host-read sponsorships with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.